Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of Ring of Fire Radio. You know what? We can't survive without your help. 2020 may very well be our last year. We need your help to make it through it. You can become a member over at ROFpodcast.com. When you do, for just change in your pocket a day, even less, you get the full radio program. That's 3 hours of radio content, minus, of course, the commercial time. Plus, you get access to over 10 years worth of our archives. And like I say, you keep the show on the air. So if you can spare a dime or two, head over to ROFpodcast.com. Support this program. Get more of the show that you're missing. Keep us around doing Ring of Fire Radio on the radio and as a podcast. Either way, thanks so much for listening. Have a great new year. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Bryce Covert from The Nation magazine will join us to explain why Medicaid expansion is transforming politics in red states like Kentucky. Jonathan Larson from TYT Investigates will help us uncover the story of a black man from South Bend, Indiana, shot by a white police officer, and how racial tensions in the Indiana city are becoming an issue for Pete Buttigieg on the campaign trail. Heather Digby-Parton will be here to help us run down all the biggest news stories of the week. And our progressive candidate spotlight this week will be with Zena Spazakis, who is running for Congress in New Jersey's 9th District. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a one-hour free podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show without commercials and access to 10 years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down the news of the week, Heather Digby-Parton from Salon. So, Heather, obviously, this week, and let's just get this out of the way. There was a Democratic debate that happened on Thursday night of this week. You and I discussed that on the Majority Report Friday. So we will people can tune into that podcast if they want to hear that, because obviously we have so much in the news. So much has happened this week that it's rather stunning. And we should, of course, start with, and maybe we might end with even today, the third impeachment by the House of Representatives in the history of the United States. The first, of course, was Andrew Johnson back in the Reconstruction period, immediately after, not immediately after, about 2 years after the end of the Civil War. Johnson, of course, was a Democrat. Lincoln was a Republican at that time. Vice President was not, you know, they weren't on the same ticket. Johnson was not on board with what the radical Republicans were doing in Reconstruction. There was he was also considered to be like, I guess, a drunk and sort of a loon, and was thwarting everything that the Republicans in Congress want to do. They impeached him in the House. And then ultimately they decided that he was so vulnerable to defeat in the election in the Senate earlier that year, he escaped conviction by one vote. Now, there was other cross currents, other people voted. So he was never removed from office. Bill Clinton, of course, in the lame duck session, people forget this, when Congress people were, you know, half the people were out the door anyways, maybe not half. He was impeached in the House, again, not convicted in the Senate. But Donald Trump, first time, a first term president, I believe, has been impeached. And Let's just stay there, because really the drama in some respects happened immediately after the impeachment, as opposed to sort of like in the buildup of it, frankly. I mean, we knew this is where we were headed. Just give me, I don't know, your broad thoughts, Digby. We've been talking about the reasons for impeachment now for months and months. And there's certainly criticisms, I think, that can be made about the push to impeachment, the limited nature of the push to impeachment, the timing. But broadly speaking, I think this is something that had to be done, and I think it's going to be to the benefit of progressives, of leftists, of even centrists, and Democrats come 2020.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think it's, you know, definitely to the benefit of the country, you know, writ large, for someone to step up and actually make a, you know, a strong case that that President Trump is, you know, committing obstructive and, you know, abuse of his power in the White House. You and I've talked a lot about many other ways in which he's abused his power, and I think he has. I think the Mueller report certainly outlined, you know, very specific cases of obstruction of justice. I think in many ways, you know, on a policy level, I believe he abused his power by, you know, moving the Pentagon, you know, moving military down to the U.S. border. I mean, I think you could litigate on that. I think putting kids in cages is an abuse of executive power. The Democrats decided not to use any of that, including all the corruption and the emoluments violations that he has committed while in office, both domestic and foreign. All of that, you know, the whole thing, the fact that he is, you know, basically, you know, taken, you know, big foreign adversary's side against his own country. You know, I mean, there are many ways in which he has abused his power. They opted to narrowly focus it on this Ukraine business because it was so obvious to any sentient being what Trump had done, and Trump himself provided the evidence for that when he released that, you know, sort of transcript that he put out about the call, and then went out, you know, immediately afterwards and said again what he'd said in the call in front of the press, and even added China into the mix, asking them to investigate his political rival. So it's, you know, it's important that somebody did something here. Now, granted, you know, one house of Congress is impotent to do the whole thing. We knew that, I think, in 2018, when the House won big in, you know, when the Democrats won big in the House and failed to take a majority of the Senate. But even if they had a majority in the Senate, it takes two-thirds to remove a president. And with the way the Republican Party has become an absolute blind, loyal, you know, Trump-following claque, there was never any case in which he could be removed under current political circumstances. So, you know, we knew that. But it's important to make a stand. And I think, to your point, that how this will benefit progressives and the country and Democrats specifically next fall is that, you know, I think these Democrats showed some integrity here. I mean, I really did. I think, you know, this, I'm not used to this. I mean, when Clinton was impeached, you know, 35 Democrats crossed the line. I mean, it was a lot. And you know, we have never had a case where they stood their ground. I mean, you had Colin Peterson, who, you know, forget him. He's really just a Republican who has a D after his name in every way, in all ways. So this was not a surprise. But for the most part, they hung together. Even ones who were, you know, definitely feeling like they were taking a risk to their own careers. And if you just watch the behavior in the House, they were, you know, it was a big, diverse group of professional adults standing there making a case. On the other side, you had a bunch of white guys screaming, yelling, whining, having, you know, basically having a hissy fit. And I think that that was an excellent sort of, you know, showing their privilege at every tack, lying, you know, whatever they wanted to do. And I think that this process, even including that, which was tedious and long, and it wasn't easy to get through, but that's the picture that you come away with. And I am hopeful that there are enough adults in this country that they will look at that even just on that level and say, who is it that we can trust this country to? And hopefully the Democrats will be able to prevail in 2020, despite the fact that Donald Trump will still be on the ticket next November.
Yep. All right. Well, let's take a break, and we will talk more about this. I want to talk a little bit about, now that we, you know, at each stage of this, we've tried to take the temperature of how we could measure if this is benefiting or hurting Democrats in their run in 2020. Because I really want to make sure that we do justice to the arguments against impeachment. But also, frankly, I think they fall apart under even the slightest bit of scrutiny. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder talking to Digby, Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Sam Seder here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a 5-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby. So, Heather, in the last segment, of course, we're talking about impeachment. We continue to talk about impeachment. Donald Trump, third president in the history of the United States to be impeached by the House. He was not terribly happy about it. We will talk about his he had a very strange rally in Michigan the night of impeachment. As really the vote was happening, and he did it in Justin Amash's district, and oddly did not mention Justin Amash. We'll talk all about that because I think it's quite people are aware of what he said about John Dingell. But I want to address the idea, because look, there's a decent, obviously the right wing does not want Donald Trump impeached. Obviously Donald Trump does not want to be impeached. And I should say it's obvious because of the way he's behaving. And we know that Mitch McConnell does not want to deal with impeachment. And we can tell by the way that he is behaving and by what they want to do. I mean, look, this is a fairly simple, analysis. You know, people say that, one of the critiques on the left we hear about impeachment is that it's going to embolden or energize Donald Trump's base and the Republican base, and it's going to hurt the 2020 Democratic nominee and all of Congress and the Senate. Well, if that is such an obvious reality, why doesn't Mitch McConnell realize that? Why does Mitch McConnell want to minimize what happens in the Senate? And I would suggest that it is what you and I have been saying now for weeks, if not months, that there are at least a half a dozen Republican senators who are running for re-election. And they want to be able to distance themselves from Donald Trump as much as possible. This vote that they're going to have to take is going to make it much harder to do so. And the more attention that is paid to this vote, the harder it's going to be for them to sort of sidestep that vote. Now, we are in right now, as we speak, a moment where we are at peak support of Donald Trump, particularly if you're in the Senate. In the House, the vast majority of them, I think there are what, like three or four districts where you have a district represented by a member of the party that is opposite the party that won in the presidential election. I mean, there's very few of those. And to the extent that they exist, they are Democrats in districts that Trump won in 2016. And, you know, you compare that to when Clinton was impeached. I think there was something like 90 Republicans. Yeah, there was only like 90 members of the House who were in a Republicans who were in a district that, you know, that, that Bill Clinton won. And so we're in a very different era right now. But in the Senate, they have, you know, we have Republican senators from states that overwhelmingly approve of impeachment or are around 50-50. And, you know, states like Georgia, like North Carolina, Arizona, Colorado, Maine, it's like 60% in favor of impeachment. Susan Collins is going to have to take a vote. And she was complaining about Chuck Schumer wanting to have witnesses earlier in the week. And you just don't do that if you're confident about your vote and you're happy to take this vote. It's just not what you do. And so this is fascinating. That dynamic, and I think it's indicative of how hard it's going to be for Republican senators to take this vote. The only thing I would say is, if they take this vote early, right, in January in the Senate, the one upside some of these Republican senators might have is that come June, maybe they see Donald Trump's taxes, the primary season is over, they can't be primaried, and then they have the ability to tack a little bit to the center because they're like, well, if I had known this, maybe that vote would have been different or et cetera, et cetera. But it's very hard to do if there becomes a fight about, like, let's hear some more witnesses, because they had an opportunity to hear more witnesses and they passed on it. And so this is the dynamic, I think, that's in play in the Senate. And the fascinating thing about it, and I have to say, Nancy Pelosi was a skeptic about impeachment. She was very slow to do it. I think she did it too narrowly. I think they have backed into this. But as of this week, anyways, Nancy Pelosi is holding up on the articles of impeachment, saying that they probably won't go to the Senate, maybe until, you know, certainly until after Christmas vacation. But that Mitch McConnell has to agree not to have a sham trial. And it is fascinating the way this is playing out. We just have about a minute and a half. Let's talk about this. I have a feeling we're going to want to talk about it more in the next hour. But this is something that we're in largely uncharted territory here. And so it's sort of hard to predict what both the leaders of the House and the Senate think they can do and can't do. But let me get your quick take on this, Digby. And then when we get into the next segment, we'll talk about a little bit more. But are you surprised at what Nancy Pelosi is doing by holding back these articles of impeachment and basically saying to Mitch McConnell, do this right, do it in a fair way to the president? Because the president wants to have witnesses because he thinks it would exonerate him. Of course, he's a lunatic. But Mitch McConnell knows better. And Pelosi's saying, do the right thing. And she's actually like, leveraging, she's actually exercising power.
Exactly. And, you know, I totally think it's great. And when I saw that she was doing that out in her post-vote press conference, I kind of cheered because I think that this is, of course, it's leveraging her power. And she's doing it for any number of, there are any number of possibilities, which we can talk about when we get back together later, about why she might be doing this and what the possibilities are. But you're absolutely right. What they're trying to do, I mean, this is the end of Democratic control of the process. So she is using her power in this moment to its, you know, as much as it is possible to use. And I think you're absolutely right. I think Mitch McConnell is rattled by this. I think Trump is rattled by this. I do not think that they want this. This is putting cross pressure on their senators and on between the White House and the Senate. Because as you point out, Trump wants a trial. So I think this is a very, very smart move. I didn't expect it, but, you know, I cheer it on. Good for her.
All right, let's take a quick break. We got more to talk about impeachment and other stories that people have been buried in this onslaught of news. We got to take a quick break. I'll be back in a moment. Digby will join me in the next hour. This is Ring of Fire Radio, and I'm Sam Cedar. Coming up, how Medicaid expansion is a winning issue in red states. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone, this is Farron Cousins, the host of Ring of Fire on YouTube.com/TheRingOfFire. And the holiday shopping season is officially upon us. So I encourage everyone out there, if you're looking for the perfect gift for a friend, family member, or even for yourself, go to MikePapantonio.com where you can order all three of Mike's novels, Law and Disorder, Law and Vengeance, and the latest, Law and Addiction, which is tackling the opioid crisis from a perspective of both fiction with a lot of reality tied in. All three books are available right now for purchase. And if you want to get your order in before the holidays, again, go to MikePapantonio.com and place your order. These are great books written by a truly great progressive and legal mind. You do not want to miss out on this. So again, MikePapantonio.com, order all three books in the Law and Disorder series.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Kentucky has seen its uninsured rates fall from 20% to almost 7% in the last 2 years, thanks to the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Here to discuss the surprising story of how voters are turning out to protect the program in red states, Bryce Covert from The Nation magazine. So, Bryce, I have to admit that my understanding of the electoral impact of Medicaid in particular was minimal. And after reading your piece, I'm starting to think that maybe this was a vestige of a different era when there was not necessarily a massive expansion of Medicaid that we saw in the wake of the ACA as a function of the Affordable Care Act. But perhaps it was when the enrollment in Medicaid was a little bit more static. But let's get into this piece. It's a fascinating piece. Focus on Kentucky, but in many respects, it's possible that this is a similar story with Louisiana. When we look at the gubernatorial results this year, and people have been trying to sort of slice and dice and try and figure out what were some of the key determinants in both Matt Bevin losing and to Andy Beshear, and John Bel Edwards, the Democrat, winning in Louisiana. Both instances after Donald Trump had come and tried to basically personalize these races. So let's get into Kentucky. Tell us some of the statistics and the sort of the backdrop of Kentucky's Medicaid expansion, one of 37 states, I believe, that has, after the Supreme Court said it was voluntary for states, adopted that Medicaid expansion.
Right. Yeah. Kentucky is one of a number of states, but I focused on Kentucky because it had such a huge impact in the state. More than a quarter of the state's population now gets health care coverage through Medicaid. And a lot of that is thanks to the expansion that was done somewhat quietly under the former Democratic governor, Senior Beshear, who was there before before Matt Bevin. There are hundreds of thousands of people now getting their health insurance because the state decided to expand Medicaid. And it's a deep red state, and yet it's having really interesting political impacts. You know, like you said, Matt Bevin, who's a real conservative Republican, came into the office about a year after the expansion was in place. And so I think some people saw that maybe as a sign that the ACA and Medicaid expansion in particular weren't politically popular in the state. And yet in this most recent contest between Bevin and Beshear, Beshear very much ran on protecting the expansion, undoing the attacks that Bevin had launched at it in his term, and saying that healthcare was a human right and he was going to stand behind it. And he won. Far more people turned out than was expected. And everyone I talked to in the state said that healthcare was the motivating factor. And I think what happened there is that over that timeline, while Bevin was in office, the expansion took place. People started to get care through Medicaid and realized how important it was to them, and also maybe change the way that they interacted with public programs, with the government, and how they saw the people in power. And I think it is a phenomenon that's happening across the country, but it's been particularly stark in places like Kentucky, where so many people are now getting their health insurance this way.
Yeah, I mean, that is a really a stunning number. I mean, 25% of the population of the state on Medicaid. Put that in context for us, if you could. What's the national average, or what? I mean, where do we see? Where is it in most states?
To put it in context of Kentucky as a state, I mean, it's 15% of the state's population, close to a fifth of the voting age population, which again gets to this political impact. And it meant that by 2017, the state's uninsured rate dropped from 20% to 7.5%, which was the biggest decrease in the country. So it's clearly having a big impact on how many people are insured, which has all sorts of ramifications for their health, for their finances. But it also seems to be having this political impact where people want to protect this expansion and also perhaps want to vote in favor of the people who are in favor of Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, I mean, that is, and is that, I mean, is this a new dynamic or did I imagine it? I mean, because I feel like 10 years ago when I was looking into this, there was a sense that I distinctly remember a feeling that the Republicans felt like they could cut Medicaid because they didn't think that Medicaid recipients voted. And I wonder if in the course of your reporting on this, are there dynamics that are at play? Is it because of the number of people? Is it because there were new people introduced to the program? Was it because something to do with we're now admitting people who are 133% or 138% at poverty as opposed to 100%? And maybe because there's different theories as to why people would vote at that point after receiving Medicaid, maybe they were just sort of like marginally more positioned, better positioned to take advantage of those things. Where is this interest, other than the obvious reasons, attributable to?
Yeah, well, you're not wrong. This is something that's new. I spoke to a lot of people who have been studying healthcare policy for decades, and they, all to a one, said to me, I did not see the popularity of Medicaid coming. It has not been like this before. Medicaid has typically been seen as a poor program for poor people, one of those programs that primarily serves low-income people and therefore doesn't have robust support from the rest of the populace. And it seems like that dynamic has changed. I do think some of it is because Medicaid expansion has expanded the umbrella under which people fall. I mean, Medicaid doesn't just serve the poor. It serves people with disabilities. It serves people who need long-term nursing home care. So there are those people who are brought in that way. But also, now that 37 states have expanded it, anyone in those states earning at or below 138% of the federal poverty line can enroll, and that has ripple effects. So it now means that 70% of Americans have some personal experience with Medicaid or know someone who does. So it's touching a lot of lives, and I think that is building this stronger base of support for the program than anyone expected. I think even when the Affordable Care Act passed, this was not an outcome people thought was going to come about. I don't think we know exactly why it is that more people are getting out and turning out to vote because of the expansion. It could be sort of the free stuff idea where if you get a new benefit, you just want to vote to protect it. You want to reward those who put it in place, which is understandable. Health insurance is no small thing when you didn't have it before to now have decent insurance. But it could also be that when you don't have health insurance, your mind is taken up by bills and trying to get care and financial hardship. And when that burden is lifted, it's easier for you to think about politics and to get involved in politics. And I also think there may be a dynamic in which people are now feeling empowered and heard because of Medicaid expansion. The people served by it tend to be neglected by politicians. They don't feel like people in power listen to them. They're people on the margins of society, not making a lot of money. And here it is, the government is doing something that is really important to your life. That may make you feel not only valued, but like you can then go and maybe make other changes and have a part to play in that process of deciding who's valued and who's not. I think time will tell a little bit which of those dynamics is going on. It may be all of them, but it's a fascinating new development.
Yeah, it's absolutely stunning. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about those potential theories that are at play here, what the implications are Because again, like, you know, and you said this, and I appreciate your validating what I had thought for years, is that the experts were very surprised by this result, because it makes me feel like I'm not losing my mind. But if Medicaid has had this type of impact in a deep red state, it really does beg the question: what if everybody got some version of Medicaid, and how would that impact the entire country? We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Bryce Culvert. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I had a dream about a burning house. You were stuck inside. I couldn't get you out. I laid beside you and pulled you close.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with Bryce Culvert about her article in The Nation magazine, how Medicaid expansion is transforming politics as we know it. So, Bryce, in the last segment, we were talking not only about the dramatic impact that Medicaid had on the population of Kentucky, or I should say the Medicaid expansion from the ACA, in bringing down the uninsured rate by double digits, by ending up insuring 15% of the population. And really, what is really stunning, and what you cover here in this piece, is the change that it did, that it created in terms of voting habits. And it's not just a change that it created in the voting habits of the folks in 2018, but it changed, it seems to me, what had been accepted wisdom about the relationship of Medicaid recipients to voting. And we should say that on top of everything you said, that at this point, you know, 70% of people in Kentucky know somebody who's been touched by Medicaid because of the expansion in some way. I should remind people that 2/3 of the people in nursing homes are there being paid for by Medicaid. So this is something that impacts people across the board. And so the breadth and the scope of people's experience with it is, I think, about as wide and deep as the population is, frankly. I mean, there is no sort of sector that's not touched by this in some way. Many people end up expending all of their savings as they're older. And so you have people who may have lived the vast majority of their lives in some decent amount of wealth, as it were, who at the end of their lives, their money is exhausted and they are eligible for Medicaid and they end up in a nursing home. And you mentioned there were three sort of potential theories about why this brought out voters. And I also want to touch on some of the studies that suggest when it was taken away in the past, or there's been cutbacks, that people stop going. Let's just start with the idea of and I'm sort of fascinated by this, that Medicaid took enough burden off of people's plates that they could actually engage in politics more. And I also wonder if that effect was in some way enhanced, because theoretically, if I'm at 138% of poverty as opposed to 90% of the poverty rate, my burdens are going to be somewhat, you know, maybe marginally less, and getting Medicaid just sort of like pushes me over the hump, as it were, and I can engage. I have a little bit more time to engage in politics.
Yeah, and the political scientists who I talk to who are studying this, like, they don't know for sure exactly what's going on, but that's sort of their favorite theory, that when your life is more stable, when you have more resources, that frees you up to get engaged in politics, to be a participant in society. And that's why they think that when they're looking at voter election data, what they are seeing is that Medicaid expansion is associated with increased voter turnout. It also changes people's attitudes such that they are more favorable of the Affordable Care Act generally. It has this really big impact on them. But like you say, the opposite is also true, that people have looked at when Medicaid recipients lost coverage years back, voter turnout decreased. Also, some states are expanding Medicaid, but then also sort of retrenching on the benefits in some ways. There's been the imposition of work requirements. People have to pay premiums, things like that. And that also dampens political participation because then people start to feel more disempowered. Instead of feeling like the government is now meeting my needs and helping me get health insurance, they're making me jump through all these hoops and making me feel like I have to prove my worth to them in order to get what I need. And that is a disempowering feeling. So it does also depend on how we expand Medicaid, not just that we do expand Medicaid.
And that, I mean, that dynamic creates some, in some respects, some scary incentives for red state governors, right? I mean, if they want to dampen turnout, I guess if they haven't expanded Medicaid, which is the case in about 14 states, I think it is, then they obviously can't do anything more to dampen turnout, I guess. But they could impose those work restrictions on existing Medicaid or in states where Medicaid has been expanded. They can impose those and attempt to basically dampen turnout, as you say. And so if that's the lesson on a state by state basis, right, that if you can sneak in a Democratic governor or one who is willing to expand Medicaid in a red state, you can begin to build a durable coalition. It feels like on some level, maybe that's part of the story, at least in Kentucky, although there's a lot of other factors. Maybe that's the story in Louisiana. Maybe we need to see more data on that. But broadly speaking, when we talk about Medicaid, what is the speculation that you've come from academics as to what the implications would be for a Medicaid for all, let's say, across the country? Because, I mean, when we look at Bernie Sanders or Pramila Jayapal's Medicare for All, really what we're looking at is a Medicaid for all in terms of what benefits are offered. In fact, it's like a Medicaid plus, if you will, but without the sort of the stigma that supposedly comes with it, because it has been associated with people who are living in poverty. Do we have any sense of, like, is there any academic research? Is there any way to sort of examine that question?
Well, some research did sort of extrapolate from the research that has been done on voter participation in places that expanded Medicaid. And from those, they estimated that if it were expanded across the country, another 1.3 million people more would vote. Wow. So it could have a huge political ramification. But I also think that Medicaid expansion is sort of acting as a first taste for the American electorate of what government provided health care for all might look like. I mean, certainly Medicaid expansion does not cover everyone, and not every state has taken part. But I do think it is changing people's attitudes about who deserves health insurance and where it should come from. And increasingly what we're seeing is that Americans are in favor of the idea that the government should provide health insurance for all. And I think Medicaid expansion has played a huge role in changing that point of view, and that will continue to play out as perhaps more states decide to take it up. And also that it has sort of the staying power. I note in the piece, not a single state that has expanded Medicaid has reversed it fully. Certainly there have been some things like work requirements that have chipped away at it a little bit, but once a state has expanded Medicaid, it seems to be there for good. So we may just continue to see that momentum build.
Well, that's also consistent with the story of repealing of the entire Affordable Care Act, right? I mean, there was this presumption that the Republicans, after having passed repeal in the House, I don't know, 52 times. I know that sounds like an exaggeration, but I actually think that it may be an underestimation of the number of times that they voted on it. When it came time to them, when they controlled both the House and the Senate and the presidency, they couldn't do it. Because of that very attribute, that it is incredibly durable.
And Medicaid was a huge part of that story. Again, this was a huge surprise, I think, to people who have been studying healthcare policy for a long time. In that fight over the Affordable Care Act repeal, one of the biggest sticking points was Medicaid and whether they were going to roll back the expansion. And you may remember that there was, disability rights advocates stormed the Capitol. They held these really powerful rallies and sit-ins. They slept in the hallways in their wheelchairs to demand that Medicaid not be touched. And it actually had a political impact. Yep. The political salience of Medicaid has been much stronger than I think anyone really anticipated, and I do think helped to preserve the rest of the Affordable Care Act as a whole.
Bryce Covert, writing for The Nation magazine, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bryce Covert is a contributor at The Nation and a contributing op-ed writer at The New York Times. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to become a member and support the show.